Hello, hello. Welcome back. I'm your host, Mona Sheikh. Welcome back to another episode of Minority Report's podcast today. Hi, James. Hi, Tim. Nice to see you guys. As always, the show is coming up this Saturday. It's Minority Report Presents Comedy Benefit for Romani Studios. And of course, our incredible headliner, Maz Jobrani, is going to be our primary guest today. I am going to be talking to him about the show. I'm going to be talking to him about comedy. I'm going to be talking to him about a life, anything that is of fun and relevance and interesting. And of course, in the comedy world, it's always good. So I am very excited. I actually have today for this very special occasion. I've just been having a hard time waking up this morning. So I've been just trying to chug a bunch of caffeine and wake up. Today's show is basically, the entire show is just dedicated to Maz Jobrani's, because this is the podcast episode for Minority Reports today. So I am very, very excited about it. There's a lot going on in the world right now. Particularly lots of eyes on Iran, considering everything that's happening in Iran, which is just really heartbreaking, and just it just makes me very, very sad what is happening about three young men who are being put up for execution, and they are in their 20s. I mean, they're babies. They're like just starting their lives. So it's really heartbreaking. You guys know that I usually am pretty outspoken and pretty verbal about things of that nature. So I just think it's so freaking wrong. I think it's awful. And I think they don't deserve it. I just really don't. When did ever speaking out for freedom, and when did ever speaking out against injustice, made you deserve being hung or being killed for what? Speaking out against injustice? That's just crazy talk. I just wanted to kind of take this moment and acknowledge it, and send out my love and my support for Iranians, and I wanted to just tell them that I am with them. I feel the love, and I feel just so much compassion for these young men who were so brave to go and protest and to take a stand. Even Trump came out today and tweeted and said, "Stop executions in Iran." So even Trump, and which is shocking, but he's somebody who aspires to be a dictator, and here he is speaking out against Iran and what is happening. So I was just reading the news on it, and Iran is the Iranian government is just trying to block everything off, and they're just making sure that the people are not getting encouraged by seeing the outcry and the support from worldwide, especially the Iranian Americans here, people like myself who are coming out and speaking out against such injustice. It's really, really heartbreaking, and I really pray to God that they don't execute these three young men, and I really pray to God that they are safe and sound, and they just let them go and live their lives. But I think you and I both know that the Iranian government is less than pleasant. It's just like, these leaders, man, the world just has to do a better job at picking better leaders. We have a shitty leader in America right now, and come November, we got to do a way better job picking out a better leader. We as Americans, as people who value love and freedom, we got to pick better leaders. I really believe that. I don't want to start the show off on a sad note, but sad things are happening, and that's why we're doing a comedy show, because we want people to come out of it. We want people to kind of see this other side and enjoy life, and see that, I know that there are bubonic plague squirrels now. Did you hear about this? Bubonic plague squirrels? I mean, honestly, anything bad that just can just go down in 2020 doesn't even shock me at this point, okay? The government even came out and acknowledged UFOs. When has the government ever acknowledged that we have UFOs? And let me tell you something, that even the aliens are like, we don't want to help you. We don't even want to be seen on because you guys are so fucking stupid. We don't even want to be seen around you guys. So we're not even going to, we're out of here. I think we probably caught them on their way out. I think the aliens were like, oh, let's look around and see what we got on the planet. Oh, just a bunch of dumbasses. Okay. We're out of here. And on their way out, we're like, no, don't go. Don't leave. You have good, maybe more advanced technology than we do. And they're like, yeah, we're out. We're out. You guys are a bunch of idiots. So I hope the aliens come back. You know, it's like, have you ever noticed any of the alien movies? Whenever the only reason that different countries unite is because they have a common goal of killing an alien, like the alien that has invaded. I think that's what we need to have. We need to have an alien invasion so people can finally just get together as the human race and stop fighting. I think that's what we need to do. Our amazing guest has joined us, so I'm going to bring him on. This man needs no introduction. He is awesome and wonderful. The very funny and talented Maz Jobrani. Maz, can you hear me?
Hi, Mona. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm trying to, I was going to do the computer, but then since the link was texted to me,
yeah,
I was like, and I was running a little behind. I just get on my phone. So I'm on my phone. So the angle's a little weird, but here I am.
No. I see you. I see you sitting in a very relaxed position. Oh, I lost you there. Okay, there you are.
Yeah, I'll be right there. I'm just getting rid of extra windows.
I see.
And I just got back from a run, so I'm leaning into the bed and because the kids and everyone else is out there, so I just came in here.
Do you just like go running around the block? Is that your thing, or you have a treadmill?
No, I go around. I like being outside. And so I just listen to like my podcast. Either I usually listen to Mark Maron's WTF, or I listen to Howard Stern interviews. He just interviewed Colin Jost. It was very interesting. So, yeah, it just gets me through it. Do about 35 minutes. You know, that's all that my knees and hips can handle. And I'm home.
Right. Used to be a runner for a very long time. Then I eventually blew my foot out, so yeah. I had to like just stop running. I mean, I don't know how would it, have you been a runner all your life, or is this like a new thing for you?
No, I always was pretty active. I played soccer when I was a kid, so I would always run for that. And so, but then at a certain point in my life, as I got into my probably like mid to late 30s, injuries started coming in, and then I would say probably in my early 40s, a lot of back injuries and stuff, and I stopped running for a while. I was trying to do like the elliptical and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But since the gym's closed down,
yes.
I just basically what I've been doing is I'll try to run one day and then just go for a walk the next and then run the next and then walk and run and walk. And it's been pretty good. I mean, it's been able to supplement my caloric intake of sweets or wine or whatever else I'm taking that I shouldn't be.
Yeah. I'm getting the pandemic body for sure. It's just not attractive. So that's why I try to wear as much black and things that like try to take me out on camera, just trying to get a V shape on camera. But man, I was, I've always been a fan of yours, and I just love your work. And also you've just always, even before we started working, I always had this perception of you as just a really sweet, sweet guy, and which you definitely are, having worked with you briefly recently. But I wanted to actually ask you, and I was researching and I didn't see anything. How did you even get into comedy? Like, I don't know that history of your life, because you were born in Tehran and then you moved. So how old were you when you moved to the U.S.?
I moved to the U.S. when I was 6 years old. That was 1978. Protests were happening in the streets of Iran leading up to the revolution, which was in early 79.
Yeah.
And my family left because my father was on business in New York and schools were being closed down because of the protests. It was also a very cold winter.
Yeah.
So we thought we would come. My dad actually told my mom, why don't you bring me and my older sister? He said, come for the 2 week, winter break, and then you guys can go back. And in the meantime, we actually left my brother. We had a brother. My brother was only about a year old. we left them there thinking we'd be back in 2 weeks. And I always tell everybody, we came for 2 weeks and we stayed for 40 years or whatever it is. And that's a pretty common story. I think a lot of people didn't know about that. And so that's why, like, when I hear things like, you know, the people coming from the caravan or Syrian refugees coming from civil war or whoever is trying to come to America, I always sympathize with them because I think to myself, you know, that could have been me. And all those people are fleeing a bad situation, trying to get to a better life. So that's what we did. We came to America. I grew up in Northern California when I was a young kid, maybe around 10 years old or so. I think I saw Eddie Murphy for the first time. Yeah. This would be like the early 80s. Fell in love with what he was doing, wanted to be like him. But coming from an immigrant background, especially an Iranian background, and, you know, Iranians, Indians, Pakistanis, Chinese, all those types of families want their kids to be lawyer, doctor, engineer.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to be a comedian, and my parents were like, no, no, that's not going to happen. So they kind of pushed me in a different direction. And then I went to undergrad and I studied political science, and I thought I was going to go be a lawyer. And then while I was in undergrad, I decided I really don't want to be a lawyer. I said, maybe I'll be a professor. And I thought that was kind of a compromise between something my parents could feel is respectful and me being in front of people talking. And so I got into a PhD program for political science, and then I quickly dropped out of that to try and get back into this acting stuff. And I'd always done acting on the side. I'd always wanted to do stand-up, but I was always too afraid to do stand-up because it's your own words.
Yes.
You know, plays were easier. Plays are someone's written it, someone's directing it, you're up there playing a character. But comedy, it's all you. And so I was very nervous about it. And then when I was in my mid-20s, I had dropped out of graduate school. I was working at an advertising agency and just as a day job. And I was doing a play just on the side, just for fun, always keeping one foot in acting. And there was a guy by the name of Joe Ryan. He was an older gentleman who worked at the advertising agency. Very nice man. He saw a clip of the play I was doing. I had a video of it. And he goes, hey, you're good. You're funny. Have you thought about doing acting and comedy? And I said, you know, Joe, my whole life since I was a kid, I wanted to do it. My parents talked me out of it. Then I tried again in, you know, graduate school, this, that, whatever, whatever. But I never completely went for it. And I said, I'm trying right now because this is when I was 26 years old. He goes, I said, Joe, I'm saving up some money. So when I'm 30, I can start to really, I can go try it. And I can do like half the year acting, half the year work as a freelance in advertising. And he said, let me talk to you for a second. And he sat me down. He goes, listen, Maz, I am now in my 60s. And he goes, when I was in my 20s, there were some things I wanted to do, and I never got around to doing it. So he goes, if you really want to do it, you should go for it. And it was a light bulb moment. And I signed up for improv classes right away. While I was in the improv classes, I found a lady who taught stand-up comedy classes. So I started taking those. Yeah. And really, anybody who asked me, what's the secret to being a stand-up? It's get on stage and write as much as you can. So from the first moment we were in those classes, the teacher would say, you know, go get up at restaurants, coffee shops, church basements, Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever is there. And so that's what we did. And that was about 22 years ago.
Wow. Do you feel like you were more born to do stand up or acting? Or I guess it's kind of 50-50 for you.
I think we're all wired in a certain way. And I think I felt alive on stage when I was 12 years old is when I first did my first play. It was a musical in junior high school.
Yeah.
And I got on that stage and I loved being on stage and I loved the reaction. I loved being a ham. I loved the attention. That was the first year with our school was seventh and eighth grade. That was our middle school. So seventh grade, I was one of the background dancers and singing and all that stuff. Eighth grade, I got the lead, and I still have video from that play, and I'm up on that stage and I'm smiling and I'm like really getting into it. So I love being on stage. And I think that I love both. I love stand-up. I love acting. And stand-up, I was always a little bit, like I said, I was always a little afraid of being the only person up there. I always felt a little bit like my writing might not be as good as my performing. But I would say as my years have gone on, and I always say in stand-up, what happens is the person you are on stage eventually starts getting closer to the person you are off stage.
Yeah.
And once you become that same person, that's when you really are starting to hit your strides. So you might not even be on stage. You might be off stage talking to your friends or your family or whatever, and funny thoughts, or you're at least writing in a funny way. and you have a point of view and you know how to deliver those jokes. Like there's some jokes that I can deliver and some jokes that maybe I can't. So
Yeah.
I think that eventually the confidence has caught up, the writing confidence has caught up with the performing confidence. And I
Okay.
love both. I really do. I love doing stand up and I love acting. I love them both.
Right. I mean, I think just like you said about being an immigrant and like then saying, oh, I want to be a stand-up comic. I mean, for me, like stand-up comedy wasn't even like a thing. I mean, I had Rajeev Sathyal yesterday on as a guest, and I was telling him that the first time I ever went to a comedy club in New York, having grown up in New York, he was the first comedian I ever saw on stage. It was
Wow.
Rajeev Sathyal. And he goes,
Yeah.
really? I was like, yeah, dude, you were the first comic. And apparently, when I was sitting, my friend who had invited me there, apparently I had turned to him at some point and said that I can also do that. The audacity at that
Well,
time.
no, I always say you're inspired by greatness and mediocrity. Meaning if you see somebody do something and it looks pretty easy, you're like, I could do that. Like you see somebody do a slam dunk and you go, oh, I'm gonna go try and go outside and slam dunk a basketball because they just make it look effortless. You know, I think that happens in life. And then mediocrity, you see somebody and they're not good, you go, well, if that guy can do it, I can do it. So
Yeah, that was in Rajiv's case. Not. I also saw Jim Gaffigan that night. So I saw Jim Gaffigan and Rajiv Sathyal. And it's funny because last year Forbes ran this article about comedians and mental health, and I was in the article with Jim Gaffigan, and I was like, oh my God,
Wow.
like full circle. It's
Full circle.
so funny how like stuff. I've been doing comedy for about 12 years now. So I've been in the game for a bit. This very important thing that you just mentioned about, you really begin to hit your stride when the person on stage begins to meet the person on, like, what do you think that is? Like, is that just like a natural process for comics, or is that something that you think comedians consciously work on to kind of meet that absolute truth of themselves and bring that on stage?
Well, it's kind of like the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000-hour rule. You got to put in the time. So the same way a doctor to become a doctor, you got to be a resident for 10 years or whatever it is. Similarly, with comedy, I think when you first start, you're emulating the people that inspired you. So you're trying to be Eddie Murphy, you're trying to be Richard Pryor. Even your intonations might be like theirs. And then eventually, then early on, you also a lot of times you're not confident enough to go up and talk about the subjects that you want to talk about. You talk about the subjects you think your audience wants to hear about, because you might look at an audience and be like, oh my God, this is a drunk audience. I'm going to just do dating material because that's all they're going to be able to take. Whereas you might want to do material about depression. You might want to do material about your immigrant what experience. You might want to do, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that you choose to talk about.
Right.
So eventually, I think you gain that confidence to go up there and go, okay, you know what? I'm gonna talk about the stuff I want to talk about, or I'm gonna find my way into that conversation with this audience.
Yeah.
So I think eventually that confidence level, and ultimately when people go to a comedy show, they want to know that you're in control. So
Right.
that's why if somebody heckles and you can handle them, I think that puts everyone, they're like, oh wow, this person's got it, you know, as opposed to if they heckle you and you're like, oh, then the audience goes, oh no, I just, you know, they cringe for you. So
Yeah.
it all goes hand in hand, I think. It's just doing it and doing it. And it's not a fake confidence. It's like,
That's
you
right.
know, this is who I am, this is what I've been doing for this long. Is it to the point where you might even like get into a situation where someone keeps interrupting you and you should be comfortable enough to go, hey, listen, man, I've been waiting, you know, all day to come up here and do this. And
Exactly.
I just want to talk right now. I got to get this off my chest. I got X, Y, and Z going on. If you're really that into like yelling, just get up and get the hell out of here. You know, like be confident enough to like confront people in that way, you know. So yeah, I just think it's a natural thing that happens.
Did you when you started off? I mean, my God, that's you started off what in like what early 90s?
1998,
Well,
98, summer of 98.
okay, wow, summer of 1998. So one day you were just like, all right, I'm gonna go up there, and you wrote out some jokes. You're like, I'm gonna go and hit up an open mic. What was
No, it
that?
was a little different. It was a little different. So this class that I took, first of all, I tried to do an open mic before in 1993. I did two open mics in 1993 because I entered a stand-up comedy competition.
Okay.
And I did an open mic when there was an improv in Santa Monica and there was a place called Gallagher's in the Valley. And I did open mics at both of those. But then I didn't know what to do with it after that. I was going to go to grad school, and I was like, okay, now what? And I just let it be. Second time around, when I come around, I take the stand-up comedy class. And I always tell people, I go, if you feel confident enough, just start going and doing open mics. If not, then get into a class. The good thing about a class is when you try your material in front of the class, it's like doing an open mic.
Yes.
But they are forced to give you feedback because that's part of the class. So the students give you feedback. The teacher gives you feedback. You don't get feedback at an open mic unless if you go with a friend of yours.
Yes.
And you guys can talk about the set. So that was good for us. So she would say like, okay, pick something about yourself that makes you different than everybody else. So you're going around the room and someone's like, well, I'm gay. And someone says, I'm black. And someone says, I'm tall. And someone says, I work as a, you know, whatever, an electrician or whatever it is. Great, 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 great. What about you? And I'm like, well, I'm Iranian. There aren't any other Iranians here. Great. Okay. So talk about that. Like, what's a phrase you can come up with that has a point of view, like an opinion? Okay. My opinion is it's hard being Iranian in America. Great. Go do some bubbles, write about that. See what you can come up with. You'd go home, you'd write some jokes. You'd get in front of your like comedy partners and you would try it with them over during the week. It's like homework.
Yeah.
And they give you some ideas and this and that. And then you go come back in the class the next week and you would all perform your 3 minutes or whatever it is. And the goal was to have a total of 5 minutes after the 8 week class. And so in between, you would meet with your comedy partners. You would find open mics 3 minutes at a coffee shop where you pay $5 to give you a coffee in 3 minutes. Again, a place like a bar in Malibu where no one's paying attention, but it's all about just getting up, trying. Eventually, by the end of that 8 weeks or whatever it was, you do a showcase at the Improv in Hollywood, and it's packed because everyone's brought their family and friends. And it was interesting because I think I had so much already in my mind that was I was ready to go. Like by the end of that 8 weeks, a lot of people had 5 minutes and they were ready to go. I had already written like 10 minutes. And me and one other guy were clearly the strongest out of, I mean, we were all not good, but he and I were at least two of the more comfortable people on stage, comfortable with ourselves, comfortable with like the jokes and everything. And for that matter, I think he and I were the last two that went up. And that guy was really funny. But one of the things that stopped him from succeeding was that he had a corporate job working at Disney and the corporate offices making really good money. And he was like, yeah, I don't want to like, because, you know, your life becomes comedy.
Right.
So he would say, look, I go to work all week. I'm making really good money. And on the weekends, I like to go to, you know, Palm Springs or wherever he went. He goes, I don't want to go to like some dinky club on a weekend and go perform. So he had an option out. So he got out. And I was the only one who didn't have the option out, had the work ethic.
Yeah.
Really wanted it, like really, really wanted it, and was willing to just keep going and going, you know.
Moz, do you think like this thing that you just said, like that hunger, you know, if you're making good money, right, you have to really want to love this to be like, I am going to give that or slowly move away from that comfortable zone that I'm in. Versus like he had this good job and great job that he's making money and has a certain lifestyle. But with you, you didn't have that kind of like Disney gig. Maybe I don't know what like your financial standing was at that time, but you had that hunger that he didn't. Would you say that hunger kind of outdoes talent maybe sometimes, that level of hunger?
Well, it's got to be a perfect storm, right? It's got to be a lot of it. Like, I think there are, you know, there were people in that comedy class. I think I took another, I forget which one. I took a couple of comedy classes. And in one of them, I met this lady. She was very nice, but she just didn't have the it factor to be a successful comedian. She could have just remained whatever level she was, but she just wasn't going to go to that next level. And I would see her years later still doing it and felt like it hadn't clicked. And I'm sure at some point it might click a little bit, but it wasn't going to click 100%. And what I mean by that is it's not that like I am so exceptional. I just think that everybody's wired a different way. So there are the comedians you see that are out there that are successful. I think they were all wired to do what they do. There's a level of confidence that comes with it. There's a level of comfort. There's a level of performance. There's a level of confidence in like, or opinions. There's all that stuff has to come together. Plus you got to put in the time. So when you see, like I was listening to the Colin Jost interview on Howard Stern, and he was talking about how Jerry Seinfeld still goes and writes every day. And you know, Chris Rock, when he wants to do a special, is in the trenches. And you see some of these guys going. I mean, you know, the best out there right now, Dave Chappelle, he's putting in hours and hours, you know, all the time. And so you got to put in the time, and you've got to be wired for it, you know, because this whole 10,000 hour rules, again, the Malcolm Gladwell thing, which is like put 10,000 hours into something and you'll be good at it. Well, I could put 10,000 hours into basketball, but I'd never be a professional basketball player. Mm-hmm. I might be a pretty good shooter, but I'm never going to go that far. Similarly, with comedy, there's certain things, and you can tell when you see someone who's young and new and they've got something, you go, wow, I've actually had that conversation with people before and said, you really got something. And I know you've only been doing this 1 year, but stay with it.
Yeah.
And you see the results in those people. So it's a combination, you know, you have to put in the time, there's no ego, because you're going to get bumped a lot. You'll be getting ready to go on stage and a celebrity comes and goes, I'm going to go up. And, you know, now you're going up at 1:30 in the morning in front of three people, but you got to love it. And I think that's in every business. I think every line of work that you decide to do, there's going to be politics. There's going to be a lot of struggle, but that's why you got to really love it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you talked about when you were doing the stand-up class and they asked each person, like you said, you know, Iranian. And then they said what, you know, to come up with one line, and you're like, you know, being an Iranian is very difficult in America. Do you feel like when you started off comedy versus what it is now, were you, when you would go on stage and when you started booking shows and comedy clubs, were you like expected to just talk about only certain topics and while other topics were off limit for you? Like they expect Maz Jobrani to go up there and talk about issues. Like Maz Jobrani.
Not necessarily. Well, listen, first of all, nobody knew who I was. So I could have gone up back then and been like, whatever. I love burritos. You know, nobody, I mean, as long as you make it funny. Right.
Yeah.
I just was taught from that point of view to talk about what makes you different in this room. And there's pros and cons to it, right? The pro is that when you're on that lineup, people are going to remember you. Like, oh, that's that Middle Eastern dude, the Muslim dude, whatever they're going to say, right? They're going to remember that in a lineup of a bunch of people that are just talking about relationships, right? You'll stand out.
Sure.
The con is that eventually people start pigeonholing you. So to this day, people will say, oh, Iranian comedian Maz Jobrani, or Iranian American comedian Maz Jobrani. And I'm like, well, I'm a comedian that happens to be Iranian American. But if you watch my show, I talk about, you know, being an immigrant. I talk about being a parent. I talk about getting older. So in an hour plus, there might be like 15, 20 minutes of immigrant stuff. And even with the immigrant stuff, it's not all like Iranians are this, you people are this. It's like immigrants are like this. And I think even when you talk about being an immigrant, a lot of people that aren't immigrants relate. So I'm trying to make it as relatable as possible. I think it's relatable. One of my favorite things is when I do shows and I see people from different backgrounds present. And I think that's important, because that just shows that all of this stuff is pretty universal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what people expected, if they expected me to be a certain way. I mean, at a certain point, you do get to a point where your audience is, once you have a fan base, now it's hard to necessarily do a full switcheroo, you know, you better talk about, but I think that they also get close, the fans that start following you are closer to the issues that you are interested in. So the issues that I'm interested in now aren't necessarily just the Iran stuff, but it's like politics. So when it's politics, it's probably more left-leaning politics. So my fans that come to my show know to expect that from me.
Right.
You know, that's not bad. That's not a bad thing. I think it's good to have a point of view, because if everybody loves you, then you're not saying anything.
Right.
But if you have a point of view and you're like, this is who I am. I'm kind of a left-leaning, you know, liberal type dude who loves, you know, I'm very international. I've traveled. I've got wife and kids. So all of those subjects might come into play here. And I have silly humor. Like I might do a fart joke in the middle of that all. So, you know, you can't please everybody, and you shouldn't want to please. You should be up there talking about whatever you want to talk about.
Right. Right. Speaking of wife and kids, now you have a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old.
Son is 12. Daughter is 9. Yes.
Okay. And you married an Indian woman?
Yes, yes.
Married
an Indian woman.
Who's a lawyer? She's a lawyer, right?
Yeah. She was a lawyer when I first met her years ago. She was working for a law firm. And we came from two different worlds in a way. But I mean, Indians and Iranians are pretty similar, like with our foods and the family, importance of family. And there's a lot of stuff we have in common.
Yeah.
That said, her lifestyle and my lifestyle, she was coming from a corporate law background. I was coming from this, hey, I want to go be a crazy comedian. But somehow it all worked out, and knock on wood, now we got two kids that we get to be in lockdown with.
That's amazing. You mentioned that you were going to undergrad for law, so I thought that's where you guys met, but you didn't. You guys met after that, right?
Yeah, we met a little bit after I had started doing stand-up. So I started doing stand-up in summer of 98.
Yeah.
We met on my birthday in 1999, which was February 26th of 1999. She was working at a law firm that one of my best friends was at. We were getting together for my birthday, and he just invited her along. He wasn't trying to set us up, but then we just hit it off, and you know, 20, whatever that is now, 21 years later, here we are.
Wow, that's amazing. That is so amazing. Man, that beats and are online dating any time of the day.
Well, you know, I mean, listen, there's nowadays, I think a lot of people either don't have time or it's just so much more convenient. And you possibly, I mean, I miss the whole online dating thing because that happened after we were married.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm sure there's people who find the right person that way, because a lot of people go, well, the good news is I can look at their interests, A, B, C, D. Great. Sure. That gets us to the same place. You know, we both love Martin Scorsese films and, you know, being out at the beach or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But I always think that it is. I think it's good to meet somebody through a friend. I always tell people you meet someone when you least expect it. I honestly was not expecting to meet someone that night, and there she was, and we hit it off, and it was a great match.
Maz, I've been least expecting for the past 10 years. Least expecting for the past 10 nothing has come of it. Least 10
after this episode of your show, you're gonna start coming in.
Are you blessing me with it? You're just blessing, sending yes. your vibes yes. at me. Thanks, Maz. Appreciate it. Yes, man. I hear like dating horror stories. I know it's not easy for guys, but female stand-up comics, we just have a whole set of different challenges that we face, because a lot of guys that we come across, they want to be the funny ones. And then you're like, no, you don't understand. Like, people like pay me for this stuff, you know? So it's fine. Like, you can be funny. I'm not saying you can't be. But then there's always the challenge of a guy just trying to outdo you, or like trying to get intimidated by you. So it's always very strange for us female stand-up comics. And I thought it was just me initially, but then I started talking to other female comics and they're like, no, it's not you. We all go through this. And I was like, ah, okay, good talk, you know?
Yeah, I think that's why, again, it's you, when you find the right person, when there's somebody who doesn't feel the pressure to be funny, doesn't think you got it. You know, those are fans usually who come up to you after a show and like try to be funny, or you'll meet them, you'll see them at a party and they'll be like throwing jokes at you. And I just tell people, I go, I'm not, that's not me. What you see on stage is me on stage performing and the opinions and stuff is me, but I don't get off stage and keep that same energy and wanted to be like, hey, you know, off stage, let's just chill. Let's have a conversation. Just be you.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can be funny together. But yeah, I think that what you're describing are people who probably are not very, confident or comfortable with themselves, so they feel like they got to be funny around you as opposed to just being themselves.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's always very strange and very very strange. But you know, I'm glad that you don't have to go through the dating life, because my God, it's a jungle out there. It's not fun. But I wanted to ask you, you said that your parents weren't very in full approval of, you know, they didn't want you to become a comic, and they didn't, you know, which is what most immigrant families do. You know, I mean, for me, that wasn't even an option. It's like my brother is straight out. I have four older brothers, and my brother straight out told me, he was like, girls from good families, don't become artists. Like, simple. Like, you are at least, you know, he was like, as if you're some kind of a prostitute if you want to pursue an art, yeah. Being, you know, conservative Pakistani Muslim brothers and like telling you that. So I had to, I got into a giant fight with my family at 18. I moved at 15. I moved out of the house at 18. I just packed up my bags one night and I left because I just couldn't deal with the amount of BS that was coming my way. So I actually wanted to ask you, like, with your parents, like, were your parents very, like, resistant? Did they find out eventually that you were taking improv, or you had moved out by then already? Like, what was their kind of accepting of that process?
I think that you get to a point in life, like when I was 26, I finally, that whole light bulb moment, it was all working towards this, but you get to a point in life where you realize you have to live for you. You can't live for your mom, your dad, for your husband, your wife. You can't be doing what they want. You got to live for you. Now, listen, sure, there are sometimes that somebody sits there and goes, I've got a family and I need to provide. Well, that's different. Yes, you got to provide for your family. But even then, if you have a desire to do stand-up, then go get into a stand-up class and do it on the weekends and your family will come support you. But for me, it was a thing of like, I can't please them anymore. So I really have to take that dive and go for it. And similarly, what you were saying, look, you're gonna run into a lot of people who don't see the world the way that you do.
Right.
And that's just too bad. And they might be people that you grew up with and that loved you and they might feel betrayed or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Hopefully, as time goes by and they see you're happy and they see you're doing what you love doing, they come around and go, hey, you know, I'm happy you're doing what you were doing. But we can't, you know, we really can't change their minds. It's kind of like all the politics we get into nowadays with the, you know, people who are Republican versus yeah. Democrats and all the arguments you have. And sometimes I just get tired. I'm like, I can't
yeah.
change your mind. If you're not going to open your eyes and see the world a little differently,
yeah.
there's nothing I can do. So similarly with these career moves, I feel like what you just said, I've always said that I felt when I started, I was rebelling against my dad, my mother, and the community. Because back when I started 22 years ago, there was no one in my community doing this. And it still was looked down upon like you were a drug dealer or a prostitute or whatever.
Right.
And I think a lot of people were probably disappointed, like, oh, you're throwing away your potential and your education. You could be whatever, a businessman, a lawyer, whatever it is. And I was like, I don't want to. This is what makes me happy. And it really was. It was, I had tried a couple of other, like, business related jobs on the side, and yeah. whenever I was faced with rejection in those jobs, I just threw up my hands and quit. In yeah. comedy, it was the first time that I would be faced with rejection where I might not get a chance to perform somewhere, or I would like I was saying earlier, be yeah. getting ready to go on stage and some famous person would come on, I have to go sit and wait. But it was the first time that I would be confronted with stuff that should make me want to stop. But yeah. it didn't. I kept wanting to be there. I just loved it. It was this, I mean, I was just as much of a fan of comedy as I was wanting to be a comedian.
Right, right. I mean, what year was it in your career where you were like, okay, now I'm like getting paid to do comedy? Were you like 5 years in, 6 years in? What was that like for you?
That takes time. You know, I mean, when I first started out, 98, probably about a year, I think it was 99 when I became a regular at the Comedy Store. Now, when I became a regular at the Comedy Store, again, I was the only comedian of a Middle Eastern background that was there. And I always tell people that was a big, big moment in my comedy career because it was the first time that I was not doing bringer shows and I was on the lineup with these guys who were established comedians, guys and girls.
Yeah.
And I would have to go follow these guys and you know, the people in the audience didn't know who I was. And I would just be, you know, doing comedy to crickets because when you do bringer shows, which is shows where 10 amateur comedians bring their friends and family, yeah. at least when you go up, your friends are going to just give you gratuitous sure. laughs or something. But yeah. when you're in front of an audience that doesn't know you and you're following someone who's headlining in Vegas or whatever,
yeah,
you're dying up there. But that made me grow as a comedian. That made me want to. I remember one night I was on stage at the Comedy Store. I think it was around 1:45, and there was a comedian named Freddie Soto who's passed away since. He was a Mexican comedian. He was one of the funniest people I knew, and he was sitting in the back, and I was doing my show. And at the time, I wasn't comfortable leaving my set to talk to the audience. But that night, there was only three people in the audience. Besides Freddie, there was two nerdy guys and a really, you know, beautiful girl with her, with them. And I'm doing my act, and there in the corner, I'm just doing my act to an empty room except these three. Finally, I was like, okay, I go, guys, I got to stop this. I go, I'm just curious, how did you two end up with her? And that became the conversation. They started laughing. I started laughing. And then I would do, you know, I'd throw out, you know, it was like a big night of riffing.
Yeah.
And when I came off of stage, Freddie was in the back watching. He goes, hey, you're funny. I go, thanks. He goes, you know, in this business, you're either funny or you're not. Like, he's like, it's not about bits. It's about having that funny bone. And he goes, you got it. You were up there. You were comfortable. I said, thank you, Freddie. It was really like an eye-opening moment. But yeah, the Comedy Store put me in the trenches. That's why when I've had comedians that work with me and they're like, I'm trying to get better, can I come open for you in front of a 1,000-seat theater in front of a hot audience? And I go, that's not the audience you want to get in front of. You want to get in front of three people in a room that makes you uncomfortable, because that's where you'll find your voice.
Yeah.
So that was a big break for me, but it wasn't a financial break, because, you know, you get paid $15 for 15 minutes.
Sure.
And it slowly, you know, like, you know, in 2000 and I think it was 2002, I did a movie Friday After Next, which is Ice Cube's third movie of the Friday series. Right. And that helped me make a little bit of money. And then I got some commercials and I was getting guest stars. And early on, my acting was paying for my comedy career, because I would get a commercial, then I get a TV show, then I get this and I get that. I was making enough money to be able to then go do comedy for $15 an hour and not care. Right. And I wasn't well known enough to really tour anywhere. And nobody was coming up to me going, hey, I want you to be my opening act. So, but Mitzi Shore did take me, Ahmed Ahmed, Aaron Cater.
Yeah.
And she put us together as the Arabian Nights, and later, and Sam Tripoli was part of it too. And then we became the Axis of Evil.
Yeah.
And that was, I think we started doing big shows as Axis of Evil around 2005. And that's when we started to make a little bit of money, a little bit of money. And then it wasn't until 2007. So now that's about 9 years in, when we filmed a comedy special and Comedy Central put it on as the Axis of Evil comedy tour.
That's right.
That helped us a lot. And then we toured around the country that year. In 2007, we toured all over the country, and we made decent money. And we were just that's when people started to get to know me as Maz Jobrani, as opposed to the character from Friday After Next.
Wow.
So I think around 2007 is when I started to make decent money. And then 2008 and on and on and on, I was able to then start a solo career. And that's when really then all of a sudden then my stand-up career was subsidizing my acting career. So I could like say no to parts, or if I went for a while without getting a part, I was fine because I was making money doing stand-up.
Yeah. Do you think, like, I'm sure when you know, that's one of your taglines on your special is like, I'm not a terrorist, but I played one on TV, you know, which I think is very clever. Do you think like a lot of where we are now with the roles that have come up versus when you were initially going, like, were you just always going for like these terrorist roles, like, you know, a la Walkbar?
It wasn't that there were that many. It was like early on in my career, the first couple of one of the first auditions I got was a TV show called Chicago Hope. I was going to play security guard in a hospital. Great. Then I got like, oh, then there was an audition for like a Chuck Norris TV show. You're gonna be a terrorist. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Then I actually did a Chuck Norris movie of the week, played an Afghan terrorist. I'm like, okay. Then like I played a robber, a guy robbing a store in Malcolm in the Middle, just a regular guy. I go, okay, I don't mind being a robber. So it was like, there was a couple of regular parts, you know, then it was a couple of terrorist parts. Then I started looking around. I was like, wow, you know, for the most part though, a lot of the things that come up, especially like as September 11th came through, then they're like, okay. You know, for example, my I told my agent, I said, I don't want to do these anymore. And my agent called me up one time. He's like, listen, I'm about to say no to an audition that came in for you. I just want to make sure you're aware of it. He goes, two words, United, whatever was it? What was the flight number? Like United, whatever it was. United, United 91 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, okay. They're doing a movie about that. He's like, yeah. And I go, well, are there any like good job, like good guy parts, or are they like FBI parts? He's like, yeah, but those are all gonna be white guys. I was like, all right, well then let's just pass, like, because it was like, you want to become play one of the hijackers? I was like, no, I really don't.
Yeah.
So I think what it took, and I think what is continuing to happen, is we need to have creatives, people that are creating stuff from our backgrounds. So that's where you do run into like a Kumail Nanjiani, you run into a Mindy Kaling, you run into a Rami Yusuf. Once these guys start creating more and more and more, and I think Hollywood starts seeing that, oh, this stuff can cross over and be funny.
Yeah,
that's how that change happens. And it's happening slowly but surely, but yeah, it takes time. It takes time.
I mean, when you were going out for auditions, how many more other Middle Eastern guys were there auditioning? It's like you and like one other guy. How many Middle Eastern?
Yeah, there was a handful of us. We all know each other. We would all see each other. There was like your Navid Negahban, and Abu Nazir, Anthony Azizi, Sean Tube, Marshall Manish. There was a handful of us. It was actually kind of funny because they would just bring whoever, like even age range would be super young to old. And then you would run into some people, and like there's an actor named Pej Vedat who's really good. Ran into Pej one time, and he was like, "Yeah, man, I sent you an email a few years back, and you responded and really helped me want to get into this." And I was like, "Oh, wow, that's amazing!" And here he was, like, we're competing for the same part now. I'm like, I shouldn't have told you to come out here.
I should have discouraged you when I had the chance.
Yeah, so there was a handful, and you got your Asif Manvis were on the East Coast doing their things, and. So there was a handful. I mean, I have pictures. I ran into Hasan Minhaj when I was doing comedy. He was like just hanging out with Darren Carter. I didn't know who he was. He was just some kid. He was like an 18-year-old kid. I was at this big comedy show in Northern California in an outdoor amphitheater. And there's a picture of me and Hasan. And I was like, oh, wow, that was you, you know. even Rami, like a few times early on when he was in L.A., I was like, you want to get up and do a guest spot on my show? Sure, you know. So
yeah,
it's good to see these people now, and there's so many more. And so it's an encouraging thing. It's nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because maybe 6 months before Hasan got his gig on The Daily Show, Hasan and I were standing in the hallway at the Comedy Store, and I turned to Hasan, and I was like, man, I was like, sometimes I wonder if I shouldn't have moved to LA. Maybe I should have just stayed in New York. You know, maybe I'll become a better comic living in New York versus LA. And he's like, no, Mona, don't say that. LA has a lot of great opportunities. You'll get your chance. And then 6 months later, he ended up getting The Daily Show, which was, which is great. And now he has his own Netflix show.
The difference between New York and LA is in New York, you really can get on like 7 to 10 times in a night. So I think the New York comedians tend to be a little more chiseled in their writing. It's a pop-up. Yes. They're writing all the time.
Yes.
In LA, you really are lucky if you get like 7 sets in a week because it's just harder. It's just a bigger place. It's a lot further. But that doesn't mean you can't work really hard in LA. I mean, in LA, you could also be kind of an unknown and end up like getting a commercial and making a lot of money. And in New York, you're still struggling. So there's pros and cons to both cities.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. You know, one of the things that I always love to ask comics, and mainly because it also plays a huge part of my life, is like, how much does pain drive you and continues to drive you? And if pain had any role to play in you becoming a stand-up comic?
I've never looked at the pain of it. I do get frustrated with things. I mean, listen, we're living in the era of Trump, so there's things that frustrate me where they're living in the era of people not wanting to wear face masks. We're living in the era of people saying, you know, Black Lives Matter. Well, then all lives matter, all that stuff. And it gets frustrating. So at a certain point, I go, you know, it's almost like it's a therapy for me to be able to yell and talk about it and find the comedy. If I can laugh at those people, if I could laugh at those statements, if I could laugh at, sometimes it's my own foibles. Sometimes it's like, you know, the fatigue with which we get through life when you have young kids. I mean, I love my kids, but sometimes I'm like, you know, just recently under the lockdown, I was thinking, God, you know, I took them to go play tennis and we went for lunch. Then we like went to the beach. Then we went for blah, 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 blah. And I look at my watch. I'm like, it's only been an hour. You know, I'm like, how much more time do I got to do this? So all of that is, it's not pain. It's not so much like, oh my God, you know, I was, you know, left in an orphanage as a child and all that. But it is, it does come from frustrations. And maybe part of wanting to make people laugh is also like coming from another country as an immigrant and coming to America and wanting to make friends and thinking maybe comedy is a good way to make friends. If you really want to analyze it, maybe there's some of that. maybe wanting to be laughed at and accepted is some of that, you know, maybe rebelling against my parents a little bit, you know, what they wanted, and showing that I can do it. So, you know, if you really psychoanalyze it, maybe there's some pain somewhere, but a lot of it is more like frustration, feeling of injustice. That's why I always feel like I want to punch up, like I want to make fun of leaders. I never want to punch down, you know. That's what gets me upset when I hear again from the right, sometimes when they attack people that are less that have been persecuted, and I go, you.
Maz, I lost you there for a sec.
Just came in. Sorry.
Oh.
Are you there? Can you see
Hey,
me?
I can't see you. I can hear you.
I'm here. Hold on. I see the square. Do it again. That's weird.
Let me see. Do you want me to?
Oh, I forgot to put the do not disturb up.
Oh, that's
I'm
okay.
putting it, I'm hitting it, and it's
I
there's
see a
that, and then there's
circle.
that. What?
Circle.
Let me close the window and bring it. Hold on 1 second. Hold on. You're still there, right?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're
I'm
still
here.
there? Okay, let me see if this does anything.
I am here.
There we go.
There you are.
Okay.
Ta-da! There you are. Oh, was it a call coming through? Is that what that was?
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah,
No.
I forgot to put do not disturb on my phone.
That's all right. No, I am always curious about how pain is a driving factor. I recently have been at like a crossroad as a comic about, you know, like what really is my voice? Like, what am I about? And I feel like, I don't know if you went through that where you're just like, what am I really about? Like, what is the kind of stuff that I'm really passionate about? And, you know, I've definitely gotten to a place where I'm like, I want to talk about stuff that I'm passionate about, like, regardless of, you know, people like it or not, then you just find your fan base that way. But I think I actually wanted to ask you, and we don't have to delve in it too much. I know that your sister, I was reading your sister's story, and it's really scary because what she went through at a very young age, you know, and you talked about it in a brief note when she passed away about, you know, take care of yourself and go get your health checked and stuff like that, you know. And I was just like, oh my God, you know, I actually recently got diagnosed with a brain aneurysm behind my right eye.
Wow.
So yeah, which is crazy because I don't know if you heard the one of the hosts of MythBusters. It was 49 years old.
Yeah.
He recently passed away of a brain aneurysm because people, you know, he probably just never got thought about getting his brain scanned. And it really kind of hit home for me because she was around my age when she got diagnosed. And that really scared the crap out of me. And I was just like, yeah, you can't really take your life for granted, can you? Like, you think, oh, I'm young, but then you have all these things happening in your body that you're just like, no, I'm fine. I'll be fine. So I actually made an appointment with a neurosurgeon. That's how my father passed away, actually. Very young man, 56 years old, brain aneurysm, you know, it burst, and you know, he was hemorrhaging for 2 days all by himself in Pakistan, and we weren't there, and he, you know, and then sadly he passed away very soon after that. So it really kind of resonated with me. Do you feel like that level of pain and that loss of such a close sibling, and it sounds like you were very, very close to her. Does that play any kind of role in your comedy? Does that have any kind of undertones or anything on your art somehow?
Look, if you can, yeah, if you can find ways to honor them and bring them into your art, then fantastic. I mean, one of my goals is for people to remember my sister, and she made a documentary about her battle with breast cancer. And one thing that I take from that film is this lust for life. She really lived her life. She saw the world. She did a lot. And yeah, if I can, like, I recently did a what you call it? I recently did a wrote a pilot, a TV pilot, and I created a character with her name in the hopes of, like, you know, having that character on TV, you know. So if you can, you try to find those influences, you try to find those places. I mean, I tried to do some stand up thinking it might be therapeutic for me, but it was really hard to make any of that funny, because, you know, unless if, you know, but I've seen, like, you know, like Lori Kilmartin recently lost her mother, who was older, and she lost her to coronavirus. But she was on Twitter talking about how she couldn't see her, And yeah. she was tweeting, and some of the tweets were actually very funny.
Yeah.
So I think that you can definitely turn some of that stuff into comedy. You know, you share, you look, you find it, you know, it's like, you know, whatever that take is,
yeah.
It's like, just, it's having an opinion about it, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever that is. But yeah, it's not essential. You don't have to, like say, oh, I just lost my dog, therefore let me go do jokes about the dog. You know, it's like,
right.
Maybe I do, maybe I don't.
Yeah. I mean, you know, have you watched Hannah Gadsby? Have you watched her first and her second special, Hannah Gadsby?
I saw the first one, and I'll tell you, it was, So that's, you know, you can go there. I mean, I think she did, and she went, like, because I think the difference between stand-up and a one-person show is, in a one-person show, when you watch, let's say, John Leguizamo, he has these moments where he gets really emotional and poignant, and you're watching, and you're, like, on the edge of your seat, and, like, where's he going with this? And then he'll have, like, a joke, or he'll have something, and it's amazing, and I admire that, and I really wish I could do that. Similarly, when I saw Hannah Gadsby, I was like, wow, that takes a lot of courage to just sit in so much silence and seriousness in the middle of a stand-up comedy show. I've done a little bit of that. I did it in my Netflix special where I took a moment to talk about Trump's words have meanings. And there was a guy in Kansas who had recently shot a couple of guys thinking they were Iranians, but they ended up being Indians. And I was just trying to say, like, when Trump talks about all this stuff about, you know, Muslims and this and that, some redneck in Kansas is going to take his words and go shoot somebody. So I took a little bit of, you know, moment to talk about some serious subjects. But for the most part, if I bring on a serious subject, I'm coming with a punchline pretty fast. Like, because I just feel like the audience is waiting for it. Unless, again, like I said, you almost got to, like, workshop it in a place that's not a comedy club, or it's a comedy show that has been set up with, like, an alternative audience. So they're aware that you're going to have moments of seriousness that might not have a punchline. You understand what I'm saying? So it's a tough thing to workshop, but if you find the right places to do it and you find the right ways to do it, and if you could take, even Hasan Minhaj's Homecoming King had a lot of moments of, you know, poignancy. So those, again, that goes into, like, a one person show a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I think it's a beautiful thing. I just think you gotta kind of be in the frame of mind for it.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like when I watched Neil Brennan's Three Mics.
You're muted. I can't hear you.
Oh, okay. You can. I'm not muted. Can you hear me?
You can hear me, right?
I can hear you. Yeah.
It says, I can't hear them. What does that mean? Somebody. Can't hear someone. There's a rare bug in Safari that can cause this. Try clicking this button to fix it. If it doesn't work, Oh, there you are. You're back.
I think it's all the Trump talk. I think it's the...
Well, nowadays when it says click this button, I hate clicking any button because then it's like, oh, we got your number. I'm like, oh,
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. Now, we have, you and I, we're doing this show on Saturday, July 18th, 7 o'clock. I'm very excited. Now, you've known Navid for a very long time, right?
Yeah, I've known Navid forever. He's a sweetheart of a human being. He's very talented. He's very intense. And, you know, he's got this Romani Center where he's put his money into creating like an artist's center where you can, artists can go and create. And so God bless him. And obviously with coronavirus, you know, it was harder to keep building it. But I think he's been doing some fundraising to try and, make this thing. So you know, you reached out, you said, should we do a show? I said, of course. I'm hoping people come on. I'm hoping we raise a little bit of money for it. You know, as you know, this thing now in Iran with these Iran is getting ready to execute a few protesters from protesting that there were from last year's protests. And you know, the Iranian government is notorious for being despotic and doing this. And I guess there's like some crazy horrible number of like executions that they've done. And it's very politically motivated, and it's just a horrendous thing.
300 have died thus far, 300.
Yeah, it's really bad. And so there's a movement now online to try and bring attention to it. I don't know what it can achieve, given that the government, again, is notorious in Iran for being totalitarian and oppressive. But yeah. I do hope, I heard that, I think I, because I had a busy day, but I heard in passing that I think that the, at least the three young men who were going to be executed, I think some judge has intervened and is going to like listen to the case again or something. That's what I read.
Oh, really? Okay.
But you know, fingers crossed, because it's, it's sad. So it's really hard also to try and, even though Navid's event is a cause for a great cause.
Yeah.
It's hard to also promote on social media for a comedy show when you have issues like that out in the world, because people find it to be insensitive, even though you go, look, this is actually an artist center that's helping artists who might not have a place to live even. Navid said, if you need a place to live, come live here. Yeah. So it's a good thing that we're trying to do this Saturday. But we're also trying to stay supportive of the protesters in this movement of stop the execution. So it's kind of a balancing act.
Yeah. Yeah. It, it always, it just, it seems like the entire world is on fire. You know, there's a bubonic plague with the squirrels coming through. I'm like, we had a, there was a, like a swarm of locusts that were in India and Pakistan and Africa. This past May, a bunch of people died because of it. I mean, it's just every day something. But actually, Trump tweeted today about the three guys that are, you know, and he tweeted against Iran government and the Iranian government and said, you know, to stop the executions. And this is not right. The protesters are to be punished. I'm like, ha, listen to this guy. I'm like, weren't you talking crap about protesters here? Like,
yeah, it's a really hard, we put ourselves in a bad position to be able to make any kind of statement, given the way we've treated our protesters, given the fact that, again, I mean, you know, Iranians are divided on the Iran nuclear deal, but I felt that at least it brought Iran and America into communication. Yeah. And it would have at least allowed us, if we were doing business with Iran rather than sanctioning Iran, then at least we would have had some
leverage
to say to them, hey, guys, you know, if you guys keep doing this kind of stuff, we're going to pull out again or whatever it is, like some leverage. But now there's zero leverage.
Yeah.
And, you know, Iran's not going to listen to America. And then also, if you look at our own way we dealt with our own protesters, it's just we're not in a great place. But the Iranian government is oppressive. And if we can get the word out and maybe someone within the Iranian government will turn around and at least say, okay, these three guys, I mean, as far as I know, they were just protesters. I don't think that they did anything that would
They were just protesting. Yeah, they were just protesting. They actually, two of them were actually head out to Turkey. They were in the refugee camp there, and Turkey ended up deporting them and then going back, and that's when the government nabbed them. So it's a really, honestly, it had, just like you said, had we not put the sanctions that we did, I mean, that was the whole protest about, because the sanctions caused an inflation, caused all the petrol prices to go up, people were taking it to the streets, they're like, oh my God, there's so much corruption, there's, you know, just to eat, it's so expensive, like, forgot, and these people are going out and protesting, and then you're getting killed on top of it, I mean, my God, man. And, you know, it's,
no, I feel for the people of Iran. It really is. I mean, anybody who pays attention to it, they really are in a bad situation, because on the one hand, they've got their own government that's highly oppressive.
Yeah.
You know, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, just in regular, like young people that want to live their lives. They bother them in many ways. And
that's
where, like, you know, that's why really there is a separation of church and state is a good thing. And I know that right now, if you look, like somebody was making the argument that under Trump, a lot of like the evangelicals want more influence of church in the state.
Of course,
so it's kind of scary that that's happening. But the Iranian people are stuck there under that oppressive government. And then meanwhile, this government in America keeps putting sanctions. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of these people that are corrupt in the Iranian government have their millions or whatever it is, just, you know, set away.
Yep.
And the people of Iran are suffering. So it's a horrible situation for the
Iranians. I mean, it's the same thing in Pakistan, you know? It's the same thing. Like, the politicians are a bunch of fat cats that have, like, you know, stuffed their pockets, and they could care less about the people, you know? They don't care if the people are eating out of trash. They just don't care, you know? They're riding Mercedeses and their Bentleys and taking pictures in their Range Rovers. And I'm like, how do you go to sleep at night? Like, don't you have any level of conscience to be like, man, I'm like looting the hell out of the government? But there seems to be none. It's but you're right. I mean, that's one of the biggest things that I always advocate is about how predominantly Muslim countries need to head more towards separation of church and state. I mean, that's how they keep the corruption going. That's how they keep their power by, you know, in the name of God, right? That's how they keep their power going. So, but no, I'm actually very excited about the show. I mean, you're going to be coming on and headlining, and Tehran is on the show. And does Tehran open for you a lot? Is Tehran?
Yeah, he's great. I love Tehran. He's like a younger brother. He's funny. He's charismatic, and people love him. And yeah, we were touring together. It was great. It's been like 2-3 years. We've been hitting all these cities. He's great. He's great on the road.
Yeah, he is. He's Tehran is. He's always so supportive and so wonderful. I actually did Persian Girls Night Out last year. It was a red carpet event, which you were actually kind enough to retweet because I think Tehran and shared it, and then you had retweeted it for me. I bet you don't even remember, but you did. So thank you for that. Navid was kind enough to come and walk the red carpet and support the show. So when he approached, you know, when I heard about Romani Studios, and I was just like, how can I step up and how can I help you out? So that's when he was just like, yeah, I would love for you guys to do a comedy show. And then he's like, let me go talk to Maz. And then you came into the picture. So I'm actually very, very excited about this week. And hopefully we're going to have a pretty big turnout. So people listening here haven't bought their tickets. We do have some VIP tickets that have been purchased already, so I'm very excited.
Oh,
about
great!
That. Yeah,
great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very good.
So yeah, I'm very excited about the show this week. I know you came from a run, so I'm not gonna keep you any further because you probably want to go and relax and ease those knees.
Namaste. I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Namaste. How, by the way, just before you go, how does that, like, how you guys, I'm assuming, like, is religion a big part of your life? Like, both of you are like, no, you guys are secular.
No, we're pretty secular. Yeah, we're pretty secular.
Yeah, you guys just do your own thing. I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you and working with you on Saturday. So thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you, Mona. You be good.
Thank you. We'll do. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Ron. All right, that was the amazing Maz Gibrani. I hope you guys joined in and listened because Maz made some really brilliant points about comedy and things that are happening in Iran right now. I actually am going to be putting out a special video tomorrow for what is happening in Iran and the execution of these three young men who were simply standing up for justice, simply standing up for their rights, and their lives are not being jeopardized. So please be on the lookout for that video. If you haven't bought the tickets yet, please do. Tickets are only $10, and we are going to run out of them because we only have a limited number of, tickets open for this. So go buy the tickets. I will put the banner up here for you. You can buy them. It's this Saturday, July 18, 7 p.m. Pacific. The tickets are only $10 online, and you can buy them on minorityreportswithaz.com. I'm going to be also interviewing Navid, who we just talked about, the actor, Navid Naghaban. So I'm very excited about him. And of course, Tehran is going to be on the lineup, and I'm going to be hosting. And Taya Lakshmi Narayanan, she's going to be on the show. So I'm very, very excited. I really look forward to seeing you guys. Thank you very much for joining. I will see you guys tomorrow at 6:15, same time. Thank you very much, James and Mark and everyone else who joined in. Love you guys. See you tomorrow. Be safe out there.